In the playground of an elementary school in Newark, New Jersey last summer, three college kids were forced to kneel against a wall. They were shot and killed. By all accounts, these were very good kids in a very bad place. A number of people were arrested, six were charged, and among those being tried are teenagers. The police say this kind of incident is not that uncommon for the tough suburbs of Newark, places like Irvington and Maplewood. They're places where kids belong to gangs, where they live by rules of the street, either because there are no rules at home or because there is no home. Yet there are still people who try to reach across the lines that divide neighborhoods like this. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
I'm joined today by two young men. Now, if you were to pass the two of them on the street, you might not know that they came from such very different backgrounds. I'll talk first with Dukens Falez. Dukens remembers the exact date he moved to his suburban neighborhood in New Jersey. It was May 5th, 1994. Dukens was only 6 years old, but he remembers the date because it was a time of great hope. He and his mother had just left the violence and the poverty of Haiti, and Dukens thought everything would be better in America. But his mom was still struggling. She had a hard time even buying clothes that Dukens could wear to school.
I had to wear uniforms for like 3-4 years straight. I had to wear uniforms, and it was a public school. So, because the first school I went to was Augusta Street School. It was down the street. And I had to wear uniforms.
Were the other kids wearing uniforms?
No, nobody was wearing uniforms. Nobody.
So
at that time, time I was actually afraid of my mother, so uniforms it was.
What did that uniform look like? Tell me.
It was a white shirt, and it was because that was the uniform that people wear in Haiti, so she figured that was the uniform that I was supposed to wear up here. But even when she did find out that you wasn't supposed to wear a uniform, she still wanted me to dress in a certain way. So it was a blue pants and this white shirt and with shoes every day.
Did the other kids make fun of you?
They made fun of me. Even in my name, they made fun of my name. I mean, after a while, when I first started going to school, I really liked the school. Like, I was really interested in school. I was always smart. But after a while, I didn't want to go no more. I used to skip school, play hooky, you know, go to the park or whatever, wait till my mother go to work, come back in the house. I mean, they used to make fun of me.
What names did they call you?
The way I act. They used to call me, because my name is Dukens, so they used to call me Dookie. Hey, Dookie. After a while, they stopped calling me that. Because I started getting suspended every week. It was always a fight. You could say I had a lot of anger in me. It was always a fight. Like every Friday, I get suspended.
You did a lot of fighting.
Yeah, I did a lot of fighting.
And even after you stopped going to school, were you still living with your mother? Did you have your own room at her place?
I was actually staying in the closet. I was sleeping in the closet. It was a long room in a closet. I was in 213 Maple Avenue. I was staying in the closet. I felt real good in there because there was a little door where I could close it. Because, you know, in Haiti, I was sleeping on the floor. Now I got a little bed.
You had privacy
closet.
Here.
You know, it felt a little good, you know. It was good. I was sleeping in that little closet. I had a little small TV, no black and white TV. You know.
So how long did that last?
For the whole time I was living in Maple Avenue, 9-10 years. My mother moved. I was about 11, 12. I stopped staying with my mother, and I was with my cousin. I moved on the other block, which was Gray Street.
So 11, 12 years old.
She sent me to Haiti like 3 times, and I wasn't really bad at that time. I wasn't really bad.
Wait a second. Why did she send you to Haiti?
In 98, she sent me to Haiti in 98 because I guess she felt that I was on the way, on the road to being bad, or
she thought she could straighten you out by sending you back to Haiti.
She really did though. It got worse. The first time, I really thought it was for vacation. The first time, but the second time I went there with her, and when she was coming back, she spent 2 weeks. And when she was coming back, I packed my bags. And I'm thinking, I'm coming back. She's like, you're not going nowhere. And she was like, you're not going nowhere. So I had to stay in Haiti. And she left. And I'm like, what's going on? And I'm like, wow. I'm like, what's going on? Like, why am I not hopping on this plane?
You're just a little kid at this time.
I was a little kid. I was a little kid.
Was she punishing you, Dukins? Is that why she was leaving you in Haiti?
She was punishing me, but also to try to straighten me out. Like, as a son, I guess she didn't want to see me end up in the wrong position, which I did anyway. I was afraid of my mother. Like, if she say something, I'd be like, yes. Even till now, if she say something, I'm like, yes, because she'll always win. But I was at that time, I was always hard-headed. I always wanted to find things out by myself.
So how old were you when you really started to get into trouble then?
About 12, 13. She moved to Maplewood. And when she moved to Maplewood, that's when I'm like, I started selling drugs. It was me and a good friend of mine. And we just...
You didn't move with your mother to Maplewood?
Nah, I didn't move with my mother. I got locked up a couple of times. Then I moved with my mother. Stayed there for like a month or two. Left. Because she wanted me to go back to school. Because I was going back to Columbia High School.
You got locked up for what?
Selling drugs.
At like age 13 and 14?
Yeah. 13 and 14 and 15 and on and on.
Who were you selling drugs to?
Neighbors, whoever was buying it.
Yeah.
There was a lunch lady that worked in the cafeteria. I seen her. One day she just came like, what's up? I'm like, what's up? Like, she went inside, so I gave it to her.
So there were like adults from the school who were buying drugs from
school,
you?
From school. Yeah. It was like when I started selling drugs, I started seeing lawyers. It was lawyers, teachers. It was everybody. Like, wow, like, you teach kids. Like, I mean, you're a teacher, you know, you're a professor, and you doing drugs? I mean,
were you doing drugs at the time, Dukins?
No, I wasn't.
Just selling them?
Yeah, I was selling drugs.
Were you making a lot of money?
I was making a good amount. When I first started, I wasn't necessarily selling. When I first started, I was just watching, and I always had money. When I first started, I was just, but I didn't even know what I was doing. They just told me to play a game. So, and the game was, watch out, look for the cops, let them know when the cops come. So that's what I did, you know?
And they would give you money for that, right?
And I get good money for it. I'm like, wow, get like $100, $20 a day. And I'm like, I make more money than my mother, so I was watching for the cops. You know, I was just getting money. And at that time, I really liked going to school because I was looking really nice, you know.
You had good clothes now?
I was balling. Yeah, I had good clothes. I had everything I needed.
How much money were you making when you started selling drugs yourself?
What, in a day or?
Yeah, I don't know. In a day, in a week, how did you figure?
In a day, I could make about $1,500, $2,000, just, you know, in a relaxed day. In a good day, I could make about
$3,500.
$3,500. Yeah, like the first of the month.
But you kept getting caught, right?
I kept getting caught.
How many times were you locked up?
About 13.
But you, because you were so young, you didn't go to jail, you didn't go to prison, you just went to juvenile, right?
Yes.
What was that like?
The first time I went there, I was actually scared. I was like, wow. But after the first time, it was okay. The second time, I got locked up 2 weeks later after my first time. I got locked up 2 weeks later. 2 weeks later when I got locked up, as soon as I went in, I just hit somebody. And
inside the facility?
Yeah, inside the facility.
Right.
And it just went on from there.
Tell me something, Dukins. Was there a time, you said you were locked up 12, 13 times. Was there a time when you looked forward to getting locked up, when you actually liked going back into juvenile? No. You didn't have a house at that time, right? You didn't have a home.
At that time, I didn't have a home.
I mean, juvenile at that point was going to give you a warm bed and a warm meal, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Dukins, when you would go back after 5 or 6 or 7 times being locked up, did you know everyone there? Let me read. Hey, Dukins, how you doing?
I had a good relationship with him. I really did. You know, because I get locked up, I have a big smile on my face. I'm like, how you going to have a big smile on your face? You locked up? I'm like, I don't care. No, it'll be okay. You know, and I go to court, and the judge be like, Dukins is here? What's going on? Everybody knew me. Everybody. It was like, I go to the court building, like, dude, Dookie Duke. I'm like, wow. It was like, I was actually popular in a bad way. I was popular in a bad way.
Popular in a bad way.
In a bad way.
Dukins Velez was in and out of juvenile detention so many times it was all but given he was headed for a life in jail. But before that happened, Dukins met another young man who was studying theology at nearby Princeton University. He's also in the studio and he's been listening. I'll find out how this unlikely pair got together in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Just a few moments ago, I was talking with Dukins Velez. He's a young man who did his growing up on the street in Irvington, New Jersey. Now, a couple of years ago, Dukins met Greg Ellison and started to turn his own life around. We'll talk about that first encounter in just a few moments. First, though, let's meet Greg. Greg grew up in Atlanta. His parents were involved in the civil rights movement. And though the Ellisons lived in the suburbs of Atlanta, they thought it was important for Greg to go to public schools in the city. And that's where Greg met his best friend, Brandon.
My first day of kindergarten, you go into kindergarten and you're new to a situation. At the time, strangely enough, I was a pretty shy kid. People wouldn't believe that now, but I went into kindergarten and there were three guys. I don't recall their names, but every day that I went for the first week, they stole my cookies. And, I was a little guy with not too many friends, and these third or fourth graders would steal my cookies every day. And, you know, I think Brandon noticed it by the second week. And the next time they came over to take my cookies, Brandon said, "Don't mess with my cousin." And this guy didn't know me from Bob on the street.
Yeah, why did he do that?
That's the type of guy that he was. He took up for me, and from that point on, he was like an older brother to me. Several years later, my parents moved into a different neighborhood, and Brandon lived around the corner, strangely enough. And we were very avid basketball fans and wannabe Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson type players. And strangely enough, I was still the younger guy, but whenever we had pickup games, Brandon always picked me on his team. Now, I was I had a deadly jump shot, but, I would not say I was the best on the playground. But Brandon picked me up. So he looked out for me in many ways. And that fostered a sense of closeness. It was a bond that we shared, and not many people knew of it, but, you know, I really respected him and looked up to him as an older brother.
And the two of you were close then for how long, Greg?
Maybe 7 or 8 years, because kindergarten, from that kindergarten experience, you know, he looked out for me, but, you know, I was still the young little kid, so, you know, he didn't want to not be cool. So I guess we reconnected when we moved into the house. I was a middle school student, so maybe in the 7th grade. Mm-hmm. And then the tragic incident happened my 10th grade year.
And that was also a basketball setting, right?
It was.
Tell me what happened.
It was the major rival basketball game in Atlanta. I went to Frederick Douglass High School, go Astros. And the other team, our rival, was Benjamin Mays High School. And we had two powerhouse basketball programs in the city. Several members of our schools went on to play college basketball, and a couple are playing pro basketball now. So it was a big deal. The gym was packed. Maybe 2,500 people were packed into this gym. It was standing room only. And before the game started, there was a scuffle. And I didn't really notice who it was, but there was a scuffle, and the police escorted some gentlemen out of the gym. Later that evening, after the basketball game was over, I went home. And the next morning, I received a phone call, which I'll never forget, because my friend Lehman across the street called me and said, Brandon was killed. And it turned out that that evening, the scuffle which happened in the gym continued. And Brandon, true to form, was at a parking lot maybe 2 or 3 miles away from our school, which was the hangout. It was the wing joint that everybody went to after the basketball game. So the parking lot was packed. It was kind of like the after game party. Mm-hmm. And Brandon was actually taking up for a friend who was involved in a scuffle, and someone punched him from behind. They pinned his head to the ground with their knee, and then they shot him in the head. And as you would imagine, this was a tragic incident for me in my life. And after many years of reflection, I've come to realize that a lot of the things that I do today are in dedication to the life of Brandon Williams and the many things that he taught me, namely standing in for another who may be in a crisis situation, and trying to just make their day a little better. And to say that he lived and died that way is often, one could say, is poetic.
I want to come back in a couple of moments to the way that Brandon inspired what it is you do even today in life, but I want to spend a bit more time with that evening, or the morning when you got the phone call.
Sure.
Did anybody know who done it?
No, and it's I think it's part of the culture we live in, unfortunately, where the victims of violent crimes, oftentimes the perpetrator is not named.
But there would have been dozens, maybe even hundreds of witnesses to Brandon's killing, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And how old were you at the time, Greg?
I think I was about 15.
And was there a part of you that wanted to go and find out who'd done this to your friend?
Strangely enough, I think based on my upbringing of trying to change social problems, I realized that to retaliate in a violent way would only create more problems.
You knew that as a 15-year-old?
Well, yeah. I mean, I grew up. Every Saturday, we were in the headquarters of SCLC, which the philosophy of SCLC is based on nonviolence, you know.
SCLC is Southern Christian Leadership, is that right?
Southern Christian Leadership Conference,
right,
yes.
Right, okay.
And my pastor was Reverend Joseph Laurie, who was Dr. King's successor as president of SCLC.
Right.
So this was something that was, you know, ingrained into who I was. It was in my psyche. So my natural reaction was to think of some type of way that we could promote change in a more positive fashion, other than resorting to retaliatory violence.
Yeah, you're a better person than me. If I were 15 and that had happened, I don't know that I would want or feel like I could be a part of revenge, but I'd sure want whoever did that to be forced to pay in some way, whether
you know, don't legally, get me wrong. I would agree that I mean, I did have those feelings of anger, frustration, and it was amazing. It was such an outpouring of love and grief. It was strange to see these students, though the schools were rivals and very bitter rivals. Brandon was a very well-known guy. And friends and family members just came out of the woodwork. There actually was a peace march to stop the violence as a result of the killing. But, you know, it doesn't dismiss those feelings of anger, which I believe are definitely a part of grief.
And nobody ever was caught or accused of killing Brandon.
No.
Greg went on to college and divinity school at Princeton. He found himself with a challenging assignment, working with juvenile offenders at a lockdown facility in New Jersey. Now, this is where my two guests, Greg and Dukens Falez, come together. See, Greg says he's preached and spoken in front of thousands of people, but nothing prepared him for his first meeting with this group. He thought he'd use a rap song by the artist T.I., but that idea fell flat.
You don't even know the head. Man, I've been in and out of trouble since I adolescent.
The class was going awful. I mean, it was the bomb of all bombs.
Everybody was sleeping.
People were looking at me like I was crazy. And, you know, this was a new experience for me because, like, I thought I was a good teacher. So I decided on the fly, I just need to be upfront, personal, and as real as I can be with these young men. So I told them why I was there, and I shared with them the story of Brandon, and I think it connected in some ways to T.I.'s story, and I thought in some ways it would connect to the young men who were in that classroom. I thought it would connect to their story, but I was surprised.
Dukens, do you remember the first time you met Greg?
I remember. I'm going to never forget that day. I'll never forget that day.
Tell me what happened. Tell me how you remember it.
He was explaining about his friend, Brendan. And I had somewhat a similar situation that was going on around that time also. But when he was explaining it, I was like, because I was always, like, say somebody hurt my family, cause sure, like, in the crew that I was, the group that I was, it was family. So if somebody killed my family, then I definitely would retaliate. I would definitely retaliate. So when he had told me about the story, I'm like, man, this BS. You know what I mean?
Come on, Duke, say it. That's bullshit. That's what you said.
I did. I'm like, this bullshit, but. You know, like, at the program that I was, just for cursing, you could get in trouble. I mean, so...
So why did you say that? Did you think he was making it up, telling a story that wasn't true? Why did you say that?
I ain't think he was making it up. I'm like, I was bullshit because you on some bullshit. Like, because why would you not want to... If that's your good friend and he backed you up since you was in kindergarten, why would you not want to... Because that was the mentality I had. Why would you not help that man? Why would you let him die in vain? Because that's how I had felt at that moment. Why would you let that man die in vain? You know, because if a friend of mine, like if he a good friend and he did all that for me, at that time I would have retaliated. And also, like, me and Greg, we two different people. You know, came from two different, you could say two different worlds. Man.
It was a clash of cultures, a colossal clash of cultures. When Dukens said, that's bullshit, right? It was a turning point, right? And I've since thought about this, and I've even thought about it critically in the work that I do in my dissertation. And I realized that what Dukins was doing, right, because it was a seemingly crude, visceral gut response, you know, because he knew that if he said, you know, if he cursed, he would get in trouble.
Right.
So he was really passionate, and I think he sensed my passion.
Yeah, but and his was as honest as yours, right?
His was as honest as mine. So in my thinking, he was inviting me to discussion, right? It was an invitation. Now, how would I receive the invitation? Would I scold him for cursing? Would I ignore him because he's interrupting the class? Or would I invite further discussion? And that's what happened. And that's how Dukins and I began our relationship, on that one invitation that was seemingly crude, profane. And in some regards, if I would have taken it personally, it could have been an affront to me as a man. And I followed up with that question, if you remember, Duke, does it make me less of a man to not go out and find this guy who killed my boy?
What did you say to that, Dukins?
I mean, streetwise, it does make you less of a man if you're talking about streetwise, but, you know, like now, that was the smartest move he ever did. Like, I think a person would ever do. But at that moment, like, I didn't really care. Like, it was, like, retaliation was that for me. Like, I thirst for retaliation. You see what I'm saying? Like,
strangely enough, Dick, after, this invited discussion. So shortly after Dukins' comment, our time was up. And Dukins and I had a personal conversation. And from that personal conversation, things began to unfold in terms of him getting to know a little bit more about me and vice versa. At one point, I'm not sure exactly when it happened, Duke shared with me, right, that I evoked that response because it was so different from what he had seen. It was a manly response in some ways, right? Because in the street cred, it's not a manly response, but in other ways, it's a complete manly response because it's something that he could never fathom. I think it evokes some type of imagination. Like, how does it feel? Am I wrong? And I don't want to put words.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. Like, it was. I never knew anybody that have a good relationship with a friend like that that would not do nothing if they friend get killed. Because, like me, I don't like a person like that. I call my brother. So if you my brother, like you my brother, I go to hell and come back for you. You see what I'm saying? So by you not doing nothing, where's the love? Like me, that was love. Like that's what I knew love was. Like, okay, go beat that person up, you know. If you gotta stab him up or if you gotta shoot him up, you do it for your brother. Or
Dukins, was there anything that Greg said that made you change your mind, that made you think, maybe this guy does have a different way of looking at the world, and maybe I should take a
moment? I never knew nobody that looked at the world like that. I never knew nobody.
Greg Ellison eventually persuaded Dukins Velez to see things differently, but it took a long time. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. Dukins tells his own story about nicknames he had as a kid. The names are very revealing of the life he was forced to lead. When he was small, they called him Dookie. But then, he says, his friends started calling him Holiday.
Even till now, they call me Holiday. And I try to let them know, like, no, my name's not Holiday no more. But some people still call me Holiday. They used to call me Holiday because of the fact that, like I said, like I came from a poor family and, you know, I, like on Christmas Eve or any time, I never got anything, no presents or nothing. And I used to go to school or just hang out with friends, and they're always talking about how they got this, how they got that, or they got a PlayStation, or they got, you know. So I'm like, And I never got nothing. So they was always talking about what they got. So I used to just take it like, man, give me that, man. I need that.
Wow.
So they just started calling me Holiday. Like, I never had presents. Like, I never had nothing. Like, so, and even till now, like, say somebody give me something, it's like, yo, what you want for it?
Yeah, that's true.
It's like, I'm always thinking, like, what I gotta do for this? Why would you want to give me that? Because in the long run, I know it's going to be something to it. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, either I'm going to take it or stop talking about it. Because if you talk about it and I don't have it and I ain't getting nothing for that holiday or whatever, listen.
Dukins admits that he didn't trust Greg at the start. But over time, and once he got out of lockdown, he found himself turning to Greg for help. We'll talk about this coming together in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Greg Ellison is studying at Princeton. He met the street kid, Dukins Velez, when he was working at a nearby lockdown for juvenile offenders. Greg didn't tell Dukins that he's working towards his PhD at Divinity School. He kept that to himself. Dukins had enough to think about. You see, Dukins eventually got out of lockdown, got a job at the youth center where Greg worked. He was getting a small paycheck, but he says it was still hard because he always knew he could go back to dealing drugs.
As soon as I got out, I went to a shelter in Washington Street. So it was worse. Like, this is not even me. You know what I'm saying? I could easily make $1,500 today, right now, if I just go out there.
So it's like worse for you in the shelter than it was inside,
like,
right?
Now I'm in a shelter. Before I was in the shelter, I was out there in the streets or whatever, or I sleep at a girl house, or I sleep over a cousin house or a friend house, or, you know, I break day and make money or whatever. I rent a hotel or whatever. So whatever it was, whatever the case may be.
Uh-huh.
But now I'm in a shelter. Now I don't even have the money to rent a hotel or do this or buy me a pigeon. You know what I mean? I ain't really have nothing at all. I came home with nothing.
Okay, so Dukins wants to go back to his old life. Greg, you're talking to him. You're in contact with him at this time. What are you thinking? What are you thinking it's going to take to help Dukins out?
Well, the interesting thing, Dick, is Dukins' case. I'm sorry.
Like what happened was when me and Greg really, really, really got along when I left the shelter. I left because I got tired of the shelter. Even my mother didn't want me in the shelter. But at that time, I couldn't live with my mother also. And I was going to Essex County College. And I started skipping days in school and everything. And we was going to a staff retreat. Was it?
Yeah.
We was going to a staff retreat. And at Princeton University. And I don't know, me and Greg, we was always cool, we was always talking. But, you know, and then at that time, like, I felt like, okay, I could trust him just a little bit. You know? I feel like just a little bit. So
this
I'm
guy
like,
you were never going to trust.
Yeah, I was never going to trust. Like, just a tiny little bit. But, so I told him my situation, like, I'm not looking too good right now, because at that time, it was either let somebody know or go back, and I really ain't want to go back. Because I got tired of being in the cell. I got tired of, you know, getting locked down, telling me when to go to sleep, when to use the bathroom or whatever. So I told them. And
Greg, did you know that Dukins was reaching out here? Did you know what a stretch it was for him to start to trust you?
Yeah, Dukins is an exceptional case. When he talked to me, he laid it out, and he said that I have one of two options. I can stay in this shelter, or I can go back home and get back into it. And he chose to stay in the shelter. And that, for me, was a signal that this gentleman is really committed to change. And at that point, I realized that, you know, we had to mobilize and try and figure something out to help him out.
Dukins, was there some point along here where you found out that Greg was in training to be a minister?
I find out when he invite me to the church, on South Orange Avenue, in Newark.
That's what, seven or 8 months after you knew me?
Was it seven? Like six months. Like 6 months after I knew him. I'm like Reverend, because somebody say Reverend, I'm like, oh, so you know me, I'm like, okay, Dr. Reverend Greg Allen, Mr. Reverend, I'm like, okay, I'm like, you ain't telling me that. He like, he told me, he said he don't like wearing this title on his sleeve. I don't remember the exact words, but he was like, you don't like wearing this title on his sleeve. And I would have never knew that Greg was a Reverend. Like, that man don't even look like a Reverend, man, it was. I was surprised. I'm like, yeah, he a cool dude. And I used to always joke with Greg, like, man, when you become a doctor, man, don't switch sides on me, because you know, like, because certain in my lifetime, certain people that like I got cool with, like I began to trust, and it was like after a while, they just switch sides. You know what I mean? They just switch sides. They feel like they better than you. Or they just, you know, like, oh, forget him. You feel me? Da da da. So it was like, oh, I mean, so I used to always tell Greg, like, oh man, don't switch sides on me.
Don't
man.
Switch sides.
Cause like, yeah, I'm like, yeah, don't switch sides on me, man. Just don't. I mean,
you still weren't sure if you could trust this guy.
Around that time, I knew I could trust him.
Yeah.
Around the time, I knew I could trust him because I was like, man, let me just give it a chance. Because, like, he started helping me. But it was weird, though. Like, all the help that he was trying to give me, I was always, like, if I'm wrong, like, correct me if I'm wrong, I was always like, it was, like, what's up? Why are you doing this? Like, why you want to help me? You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I always, you know, and even till now, I always had doubts about something. Like, yo, why you like me? You see what I'm saying?
Somebody going to do something nice for me, there must be a reason. There must be.
Yeah, it must be like you want something back. Yeah, man, like you want something back. Like, you not gonna just be like, oh, Duke, I want, like, he said, I want to invite you to my church. I'm like, all right. Because we go to the same church now. I'll stay at that church. So.
Wait a second. You said you stay at that church?
Yeah, I'll stay at that church.
You've got a place there?
Yeah.
Well, the situation was dire, Dick, and we had to make a decision quite quickly. And the church that I'm currently working at, I'm serving as, I'm reluctant to say the interim pastor, but I'm working there in a ministerial capacity. And I went to the session. It's a wonderful church of wonderful people. And it's a Presbyterian church, Memorial West Presbyterian Church. And I said, there's this young man who's in a very tough situation. If we don't help him, he's going to become a statistic. And I really am convinced that he wants to change. He's in school. He's making all of the right decisions to become a better person. And he's continually growing each day. And we worked out a deal that Dukins would serve as our sexton of our parish. And he would, in exchange for a place to stay, and a lot of love from the women in the church who kind of look at Dukins as a son, he would clean the church grounds and maintain the grounds. And it's really been a mutually beneficial relationship.
Greg, help me with one thing. You deal with a lot of troubled kids at the Newark facility. What was it about Dukins that made you reach out in the way that you did, that made you want to say, hey, I can make a difference with this young man?
Yes, Brother Greg, please answer that.
I'm a doctoral student at Princeton, and my dissertation is on hope, and specifically looking at individuals who feel as if they are unseen and unheard, and how it not feeling visible or feeling muted impacts their ability to envision hopeful possibilities. Dukins, when I met him, was muted and invisible. He was trapped in this cycle that he couldn't break out of, moving from the streets to these overcrowded juvenile facilities, to school that really didn't nurture him, right? And now he's trapped in this cycle, but he wants to change. He wants visibility. He sought visibility by punching people in the face, right? But at some point in our relationship, I realized that this individual wants to be better. And I don't know when that time was, but I could see that this young man was evolving into something great. And Dukins has an infectious personality, you know.
Yes,
his smile, you know, he wears a suit and tie to work, you know, and, you know, he really lets people know that I'm wearing a suit and tie, you know. He has a little swagger about him, which I can resonate with myself because I
do.
Think I got a
that's
little swagger.
That's what Brother Greg
too.
Do.
But Dukins really exemplified it, that he wanted to go to college and to make a better life, not only for himself, but for his family. And that being said, I was like, you know, I'm willing to go to bat for this brother.
Dukins, you think you're going to be all right?
I'm going to be great. I'm going to be great. I can tell. We got a little group called the Princeton Boys. You know? We the Princeton Boys. Man. My boss, Dr. Howard, Mr. Torrey, Mr. Lawrence Wynn, Greg. You know, we the Princeton Boys. So I know I'm going to be great.
Do you feel like you've turned a corner? You ever tempted to go back to the neighborhood where you were?
All the time. All the time.
So that temptation is there?
That temptation always going to be there. It's always going to be there. It's just a decision that I have to make for myself.
Dukins doesn't completely avoid the old neighborhood, and he sees kids there heading down the same path that he was on.
When I came home, I saw a 12-year-old. You know, I saw a 12-year-old. I mean, he got a kind of gun. He had a .40 caliber on his hand, you know, and I'm like, what's up? What you doing? Like, before I got locked up, you was going to school and everything. Now you 12. You got a gun in your hand. He's like, yeah, man, I got to protect myself. I got to make money. Drugs, guns in his hand. Like, what's up? Like, what's going on? Like, why you wilding right now? You know, so I'm like, why are you? I mean, because I knew him. I knew his family, you know. But I can't really tell that little guy nothing because, you know, his mother was a crackhead. You know what I mean? His mother was doing drugs, so. He like, I need money. So, I mean, his mother never really gave him nothing. You know what I'm saying? The only time he had clothes was when people from out there tried to throw clothes away.
So, Dukins, you see these young kids who are living the kind of life that you used to live.
Yeah.
Do you stop them? Do you talk to them? What can you say to them?
I talk to them all the time.
I know, but they saw you as Holiday. They saw you as a tough guy.
Yeah, now it's like I'm dressed up right now. Like I go to the same block out there. Like, what's up? I still know the guys. I go out there like, what's going on? Like, you switching sides. You feel me? Like, just the same way I'm always telling Grady, don't switch sides on me. Like, they feel like I'm switching sides. Like, yo, what's up? Like, you switching sides now.
That's the question. What do you say to them to convince them that you're not switching sides?
I try to let them know. Like, it ain't switching sides. You feel me? It's just, you know, using your brain, man. Like, I mean, doing something different. It was just doing something different. It was just, you know, getting tired of it. Because I got friends, families, and all that, like, every day. Every day they getting locked up, come home, get locked up, come home. I mean, it was crazy.
Do you, Dukins, do you see it as your, kind of like your job to try and help these kids?
Yeah, it is part of my job. I think that's one of the reasons that's what I'm here for. Like, that's, like Greg feels like it's part of his job. I don't know if I'm wrong or not, correct me, but he feels like it's part of his job, you know? Like, I got a family, like, you see what I'm saying? I got a family, Bethany Baptist Church, they're my family. Greg, my family. I mean,
can I jump in, Dick?
Yeah.
One of my central claims is that hope is generated and sustained in a community of accountability. And what Dukins just talked about was a community of accountability. I'm accountable to Brandon, and to Brandon's legacy and to my parents and the things that they taught me around that dinner table. Dukins, in some senses now as he's changing, right, when the impulse to do something wrong comes up, this community of accountability comes into his mind, right, of the people at Bethany, the people at Memorial West at our church, the people in the youth house. They come in his mind as a community of accountability that he doesn't want to let down. And the reason why I say it's infectious, now he's a part of a community of accountability for that 12-year-old who's walking around with the gun and trying to change how he thinks about his life, because now he sees that it's possible.
Dukins-Velez has plans to finish college, maybe start a business, and he has the support of people like Greg Ellison and others. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. In fact, Dukins has already managed to change one person's mind.
Like, I had a guy that was in program. Like, he came to me like, yo, he like, you? I mean, he like, you? Like, I was dressed up and anything. He like, you? Like, in school?
Yeah.
I mean, like, you in school working? Like, Holiday? My boy Holiday? I mean, he looking like, I mean, and one of my boss looking, I'm like, oh, I mean, but I know, I'm like, oh, calm down, brother. But he was like, yo, he like, are you serious? I mean, he was surprised, like, changing? Like, this your life? He like, man, and then he started thinking like a week later, he like, yo, man, I don't want to do this no more, man. Like, if you do it, I could definitely do it.
That's right.
He like, if you do it, he said it. He like, yo, if you could change your life, I could definitely change my life. He like, you was worse than me. My man. That's what he said. He like, you was worse than me.
Guys, I want to thank you both for being with me. Dukins, Gregory, it's been definitely great having you with me on the program. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Greg Ellison is finishing up his PhD at Princeton Theological Seminary. He's expecting to graduate this May, and he plans to go on to do a fellowship in Atlanta. Greg recently told his friends Dukins about his upcoming move. Dukins congratulated Greg. He knew his friend wouldn't be in New Jersey forever. Dukins-Velez is still working part-time at Bethany Baptist Church and still taking college classes. Later this week, Dukins plans to move out of the church and into a house he's renting. Greg and Dukins also share a love of music. This DMX song in particular, one that talks about living and suffering and surviving and finding meaning in all that.
See, to live is to suffer. But to survive, well, that's to find meaning in the suffering.
Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I got to get up. So I can tear. Hey yo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Hey yo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Hey yo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I got to get up. Back on my feet so I can tear. I've been through mad different phases, like mazes, to find my way. And now I know that happy days are not far away. If I'm strong enough, I'll live long enough to see my kids doing something more constructive with the time than bids. I know because I've been there, now I'm in there. Sit back and look at what it took for me to get there. First came the ball, the drama with my mama. She got on some flash, so I split and said that I'ma be that seed that doesn't need much to succeed. Strapped with mad greed, a heart that doesn't bleed. I'm ready for the world, or at least I thought I was. Bagging when I caught a buzz, I'm thinking about how short I was. Going too fast, it wouldn't last, but yo, I couldn't tell. Group homes
in. If you have any reactions to today's story, you can get in touch with me. Send me a note to our website. You can find me at thestory.org. Or perhaps you know of another incident where two people have come together in the same way that Greg and Dukins did. And I'd like to hear about that as well. Again, contact button on our website at thestory.org. Or you can call and leave me a message on our toll-free telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I got to get up. Get back on my feet so I can tear. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I got to get up. Get back on my feet so I can tear. That ain't the half. Arrogance gets worse as I get older. Actions become bolder. Heart got cold. Chip on my shoulder that I didn't did touch. Didn't need a click, cause I scared it that much. One deep with the starting for kicks, catching vicks, throwing bricks.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.